This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support this free service by September 5th and you could win a Mini Cooper S convertible. Go to KCRW.com for details.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The London bombings, transit safety, and international terror. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. British police killed a man in a London subway today and released closed-circuit television pictures of four suspects in yesterday's aborted bombings. On To the Point, we'll get the latest from London and hear a debate. What's made Britain a terrorist target? Anti-Western ideology or government policy, including support for the war in Iraq? Meantime, with federal money for transit safety being cut by Congress, what's being done to reassure transit passengers in New York, Washington, and Los Angeles? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Lance Armstrong for the seventh time. He's about to do it again. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. The latest transit attacks in London have sparked a new argument about why Britain has become a terrorist target. On To the Point, we'll hear a debate about that and look at transit safety efforts here in the United States. On Reporter's Notebook, after winning the Tour de France 6 years in a row, Lance Armstrong's expected to win it again on Sunday. Even he says next year will be a lot more interesting. First, this news update. Police in Britain shot a man to death in a subway this morning and said the incident was related to yesterday's aborted bombings. As he released closed-circuit TV pictures of four suspects, London Police Commissioner Ian Blair had this grim assessment.
This is the greatest operational challenge ever faced by the Metropolitan Police Service. I think the Metropolitan Police Service and its sister services are doing a magnificent job, but officers are facing previously unknown threats and great danger.
Deputy Commissioner Andy Heyman appealed for public assistance.
Do you recognise any of these men? Did you see them at the three underground stations or on the bus? Did you see them at a different location? Did you see these men together before or after the incident? Did you see them with anyone else?
Again, appealing to the public, the police officials did not take any questions today from reporters. Gordon Carrera is security correspondent for the BBC. He's at a cell phone now outside the Metropolitan Police headquarters of Scotland Yard. Gordon, pretty unusual for British police to kill somebody. What do we know about this shooting in the subway this morning?
Absolutely. Very, very unusual. It's a very unusual thing. I mean, most of our police here aren't armed, to give you some idea about how unusual this would be. And I think what that points to is that this was directly connected to yesterday's attacks. The police are making that clear. Now, however, we don't believe at this point that the individual who was shot was one of the four suspected bombers yesterday. But we understand there's a direct connection. What that probably means is that there was intelligence information which came out of yesterday's bombing, which led to this individual being put under surveillance. We understand he was then under surveillance by a covert police team. He was followed, at some point challenged. He then ran, escaped onto the tube, and there was shot.
So they must have thought then that he was carrying something, because I take it he didn't shoot at them.
That's right, and it does appear that he was shot with the intention of killing him. Now, that would only be done if it was clear that he was a potential threat to public safety or to the police officers. There's very strict rules on that, which also apply in the case of possible suicide bombers. But then, for instance, the idea is you use a headshot rather than a body shot for fear of setting off the device. There are reports, for instance, that the individual was wearing a very thick winter jacket, even though it's a hot summer's day here, and that may have increased the suspicion that he may have been a suicide bomber with the intention of doing something. So clearly, there was a belief that not only was he directly connected to the attacks, but he was in a position potentially to do some harm, and that's why they took this action.
What about these four photographs that have been released, taken, of course, by closed-circuit television cameras in the transit system?
That's right, and these are very clear pictures, much clearer, for instance, than the pictures we had of those behind the July 7th attacks. Very clear pictures which give a good sense of what these people look like, although we don't have their names. Clearly, the police are trying to involve the public when they think the public can help push this investigation forward. And they clearly want to anyone who might have seen these people after the bombings, after the attempted bombings, or since, or knows where they might be, to get in touch with them as fast as possible.
Are those pictures being very, very widely and rapidly distributed by the media in Britain?
Absolutely. Very widely distributed with the telephone number that you should call immediately if you have any knowledge on who these might be, and particularly where they are. Clearly, the sense is these people are still a threat, and they may have the intent and the capability to carry out further attacks. So it's a very urgent hunt. We've just heard word literally in the last few minutes of a possible arrest, again in South London, near where this individual was shot this morning, and we know there's a lot of leads being pursued.
A moment ago, we heard Ian Blair, the police commissioner, say that the police face now unknown threats and great danger. That must also be true of Londoners, particularly transit passengers. What's the atmosphere in town?
Well, I think there is a different atmosphere, but it's not as different maybe as you'd expect. I mean, I'm on a London street outside Scotland Yard, and it's a summer's evening, and people are out on the pubs having a drink, and they're using the transport system. So this isn't a city paralyzed by fear by any means. But I think that balance between being alert and being alarmed and how worried you should be, it's subtly shifting and slowly. But I think I wouldn't overdo the sense of fear here. But of course, the fact that the second attack yesterday, whether it was a follow-on or copycat, who knows, but the fact that it didn't work has perhaps made the fears not as great as they might have been if indeed it had been carried off and had been similar to that first attack.
Just a couple of moments left, but do the police seem confident that they will be able to solve this latest crime?
Well, they do have a lot more evidence than they had about July 7th in terms of these pictures and also in terms of unexploded devices. Those devices are crucial. They'll help them identify who the bomb maker might be, what the material might be, and crucially, that will help them then see how closely connected this might be to July 7th, as that's very much still an open question.
Gordon Carrera, security correspondent for the BBC. As always, many thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
In a moment, Britain's vulnerability to terrorism, and a bit later, what's being done to make America's transit passengers feel safer. On To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To The Point. President Bush and Prime Minister Tony Blair have insisted that terrorists are motivated not by their policies, but by an ideology of hatred against the Western lifestyle and values. Britain's independent newspaper says that senior ministers have dismissed the war in Iraq connection by disparaging their critics. But now, reports the paper, an authoritative report from the much-respected think tank Chatham House is not so easily swept to one side. Dr. Paul Cornish heads the International Security Program at Chatham House, which reported recently that terrorists really are motivated by allied actions in Iraq and in the Middle East. Dr. Cornish, welcome to our program.
Good evening.
You have said that the war in Iraq specifically has made Britain more vulnerable to terrorism than it was before. How did you reach that conclusion?
We published a briefing paper at the beginning of the week, and one part of that briefing paper was written by two very well-known terrorism and security experts, Frank Gregory and Paul Wilkinson in the UK. And I mean, to be honest, the reaction was extraordinary, and I think it only began to calm down once various government ministers had actually taken the time to read the paper, and then they realized that actually it wasn't all that exceptional and said quite a lot of what they were thinking themselves. I think, in my own view, and I think the authors of the paper need to be able to speak for themselves, but obviously they're not here, my own view is this. It's to say that there's no connection at all between, if you like, our policy, whatever that might be, and their choices or actions, that's to say the terrorists. And this is the kind of line that the governments in the UK and Australia and the United States, I think, have been taking. I think it's almost absurd, and it's to base your policy upon the shakiest of sort of ideas, really, because I think everybody sees that there is a link of some sort. And for some people, of course, some radicals, this link adds to their sense of grievance against the West. And I don't think we can wish that link away, and I think we should actually just accept it and live with it. And if you do acknowledge it, that doesn't in any sense suggest that, you know, Al-Qaeda grew out of Iraq, or that this or that policy, or in the UK's case, the alliance with the United States is wrong, or least of all, and this was, the most sort of outrageous suggestion, that either the authors or Chatham House were seeking to exonerate terrorism in any way. You know, that simply wasn't what the report was trying to do. It was trying to make a common sense observation that there is a link and that this must be a risk that presumably the government in the UK took account of before it went into Iraq.
You indicated that the reaction at the outset was really quite extraordinary. It was reported, I gather, by some people or represented as being sympathetic with terrorism.
Yeah, it was. And that, as I said, that's. I said at one point during the week that would have been an offensive suggestion if it wasn't so ridiculous. It's nothing along those lines is contained in the report, and that's certainly not my view. Chatham House doesn't take a view on anything, and so it can't take that sort of view. No, it was completely misunderstood and misread, and we had quite a lot of fun trying to put people right at the early part of the week.
What do you think, then, is the link between Britain's new vulnerability to terrorism and the Iraq war and the war in Afghanistan as well?
I think quite simply, and it's a commonplace observation, that what the UK and the US and whoever are doing in Afghanistan and Iraq, whether right or wrong, whatever your view of that, that what we are doing in those countries forms part of the grievance of certain people against the West. And that is a grievance that seems to be exportable. In other words, it isn't just in the minds of insurgents in Iraq. It can also be in the minds of these young men who have carried out these attacks in the UK in the last 2 weeks. And I just don't think that's a difficult observation. And I think you can make that observation without taking a view necessarily on whether the UK or the US should be in Iraq or whether they should get out now. I mean, I don't see the problem with it.
So has the war in Iraq then made people in Britain less safe than they were before?
I would say that it probably has, yeah.
Okay. Again, Dr. Paul Cornish is head of international security at Chatham House in London. Zainab Al-Suwaj is executive director of the American Islamic Congress. That's an organization for progressive Muslims based in Boston. She herself was born in Iraq, and we want to welcome you to our program.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
What do you say to what we're hearing from Dr. Cornish?
Well, I think in terms of the terrorism and the terrorist act that happened in London last week and yesterday, I think that these people, they do have a certain ideology that anyone who's against that ideology should be punished or should be killed. And it doesn't matter whether the allies are in Iraq or in Afghanistan. I mean, these people, they have their mindset to distribute terror around the the world, to kill people who do not believe in the same ideas that they believe in. And people get killed also in Iraq, and these people are not invading Iraq. These are Iraqis. So I don't see that whether, the war in Iraq or in Afghanistan has any link to these terrorist acts.
It is often argued that Osama bin Laden in particular began with a political goal to get Westerners out of the Arabian Peninsula, for example. Do you think there are any political goals of terrorism, or are there actions based instead on what you describe as beliefs?
I think this is most likely to be it as beliefs, and I don't think, bin Laden's excuse to have the foreign forces in Saudi Arabia or somewhere else in the Middle East is the real motivation of for them to kill people, human beings, going to their works or practicing their normal life. I mean, I think this is just this kind of act, this kind of terrorist act, is basically for anybody and who do not believe in Al-Qaeda's principles.
So are you saying then that the war in Iraq, the country from which you originate, it has not made Britons any more exposed to terrorism than they would have been before?
I don't think so. I don't think this is even relevant to what's happened. Maybe relevant somehow, but I don't think this is the main reason that these terrorists doing their act in London or in Britain right now.
Again, we're speaking with Zainab Al-Suwaj. I hope I have spelling, pronouncing your name
correctly. No, it's right. It's good.
All right. Thank you. I'm doing the best that I can with the American Islamic Congress in Britain. Dr. Paul Cornish, let me go back to you at Chatham House in London. I'm interested in your response to what we've just heard.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we're having a very polite disagreement here, which is fine by me. I'd simply say, you know, our colleague just used the term the main reason. And that's, look, we can agree on this. It might not be the main reason. It doesn't really matter. But all we're saying, or all that has been said by others and I'm saying now, is that what we do forms part of the grievance against us. And I think you can say that without saying, and I certainly don't say that we should never have gone into Iraq, or that we should get out of Iraq now, or that the UK should never be allied with the US. I don't say any of those things, and neither, least of all, do I say that this excuses terrorism. The people to blame for the terrorist attacks on 9/11 or 7/7 or whatever are the terrorists themselves. But if we want to understand why they do it, and I think we should try and understand why they do it, then we have to understand that we are part of we're part of the overall picture. And as far as they're concerned, we are part of the problem. And I just think we have to acknowledge that. I mean, not to acknowledge the link, I actually think can damage counterterrorism policy, and it can make cooperation impossible. I'll tell you what I mean, just thinking locally about the UK. The Muslim communities, all of whom oppose terrorism and they want to help in the counterterrorist fight in the UK, I just think they might be reluctant to join that effort if at first they're expected to, if you like, to buy in to the UK government's idea that the UK government's position in all respects is completely flawless. What if you are a good British Muslim who doesn't like terrorism, but you also disagree with the UK policy in Iraq?
Then you think that you'll get less cooperation of the type that police officials particularly seem to need the most.
Precisely. That's exactly what I'm getting at, yeah.
Back to Ms. Al-Suwaij, what do you say to that?
Well, I think, look, there are a lot of Muslims that they are living in Britain or in America and many other parts of the world. They are condemning and they are not agreeing with what's happening. But also there are Muslims who are agreeing with what's happening. In fact, they are helping these terrorists to do such an act. And the best example of this, that the four or three of the terrorists who did 7/7, they were actually holding British citizenship. And I think, you know, here I disagree with
Dr. Cornish
and what he said, because when 9/11 happened, that there was no forces there was not a war in Afghanistan or not a war in Iraq. So that was just came because these people want to prove a point, want to the whole world to hear about them and to know about them, and to let the world know that anyone who is against their ideology or against their beliefs, then he or she deserves to be killed. And this is just not acceptable.
Dr. Cornish, back to you. What about the history of American and British policy and activities in the Middle East, and the argument that Osama bin Laden really began his efforts long ago, and that long before September 11th, for example?
Yeah, of course he did. You know, and as I said a few minutes ago, you know, I acknowledge that, and I think the authors of our paper acknowledge that. Nobody said that Al-Qaeda or even the Taliban or anti-Western objectionism or whatever you like has grown out of the operation in Afghanistan, the operation in Iraq. That isn't the point. What we're saying, or what I'm saying now, and I think what the authors have said of this report, is that, you know, if you are engaged in a conflict, and let's call it a conflict, but let's not get into whether it's a war on terror or anything else you like. Let's simply say we have a conflict going on here. If you're in the conflict, it doesn't matter who started it, but if you're in it, then what you do forms part of that conflict as far as the other side is concerned. And they react to what you've done, and they will conduct themselves as they see it appropriately. And I think you can make that simple observation without getting drawn into whether whether I'm actually condoning what the other side does. And of course I'm not in any sense. I simply think we have to accept that we are part of a conflict, and that the other side sees us as part of it, and that they certainly see the UK and the US as being in part to blame or as part of their grievance against us. I just don't see how we can deny this.
Ms. Al-Suwaij, what about that? And we have heard on this program Muslims, including British Muslims, say that they believe, and that many others do around the world, that the war on terror is really a war against Islam. Do we have to acknowledge that belief and perception, whether we agree with it or not?
I don't think this is real, and this is related to life, and or related to what's happening right now. Because this war on terrorism is killing not only non-Muslims, but also killing Muslims as well. So what has been said about, you know, the war against terrorism is against Islam is nonsense. I think this the war that the terrorists leading is against humanity, against Muslims, against Christians, against Jews, against anybody who does not believe in their beliefs. And I think
doesn't that include other Muslims who don't agree with their form of Islam?
That's right. That's what I'm saying. What I'm saying is these people are killing innocent human beings because they do not agree with Al-Qaeda's beliefs and they don't have the same beliefs. And that's, you know, make them deserve to be killed by Al-Qaeda ideology. And I think the idea of this war against terrorism is against Islam is nonsense because most of these dictators in the region and the lack of freedom and democracy in many of these countries in the Middle East and in the Muslim world, this is how they sell the idea in the for the regular people there in the street. They don't want to tell them that, you know, you're human beings, you have the right to vote, you have the right to talk, you have the right to say what you are, whatever you have the right to elect.
Well, what about the support from Western countries for repressive dictatorships in the Middle East, including at one point that of Saddam Hussein?
That's right. I'm not telling you that did not happen. This is a fact and this is a history. But people now, I mean, especially the U.S. and U.K., trying to change their policy and strategy in the region. So, you know, whatever happened in the past does not mean like continuing the mistakes that happened in the past then now should be okay. Fine, that's happened, but now it's time to correct it, and I think that should be taking place.
Yeah, Dr. Cornish, you said you didn't want to take a position, but if, in fact, you have to acknowledge, and it has to be acknowledged, that there is a relationship between policy and what happens here, then don't you open the issue to argument? Don't you then encourage people to debate about whether or not the policies are, in fact, effective?
I think you do, and I'm happy to do that. I think we need argument and we need debate. I do take a position. What I said is Chatham House doesn't take a position. You know, by royal charter, it's independent and so on. I'm very happy to take a position on these issues. I want more argument. I want more discussion. I know what I think. I think, for what it's worth, that the intervention in Iraq was the right thing. I think it is the right thing for the UK to remain allied with the United States, and I don't think it's the right thing for the UK to withdraw from Iraq according to a fixed timetable. Those are my views.
Hold that point, because we're going to take a very brief break and come back and continue this conversation. A little later, we'll also talk about transit safety here in the U.S. and on Reporter's Notebook, Lance Armstrong, about to do it again. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from The Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Well, I'm only back with To the Point. Talking today about the motivation of terrorists, first with Dr. Paul Cornish of Chatham House in London, whose organization has issued a report from terrorist experts saying there is a connection between Western policies and terrorism. We're also talking with Zainab Al-Suwaij, Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress in Boston, who says that, in fact, they are motivated principally by hatred of Western ways and by a very extreme ideology. Back to you, Ms. Al-Suwaij. What about the situation in Spain, where apparently there was first the bombings, then the immediate withdrawal from Iraq of Spanish forces? Does that not suggest that there was a political goal there and that it was achieved?
Well, this is a political. This is these are the things that they want to prove. I mean, if Iraq now in a need to have these forces on its land to keep security, And if these governments keep pulling their forces from Iraq, then it's going to be much easier for these terrorists to take over and to control the country inside Iraq. And I think right now what's, the result of the terrorist act in Madrid and what's, what came from that, I mean, this is a proof to the Qaeda that they are, they are winning the war. And I think that these governments should be much more solid and should keep, fighting these terrorists, not by, allowing them or agree on what these terrorists want and just pull their forces and leave.
But isn't what happened in Spain evidence that there is some irrational political thinking behind what the terrorists are doing, that it isn't just a mindless striking out at Western forces?
Well, yes, of course there are some of the political ideas and all of that, and they have political aims. First, they want to do these things to make people afraid, and then they to prove their point. So later on, whatever Al-Qaeda wants, they, you're trying to tell me that whatever they want, they go and did several suicide bombing here and there, and the whole world has to agree on what they want. I mean, this is not logical, and I think people should look beyond that. Should look beyond, their what they are demanding, and keep fighting them, and until they are gone.
We just have a couple of seconds left, Dr. Cornish. Back to you. Are you suggesting, when you insist that we need to recognize the connections, well, of course, you're not supporting the terrorists, but that you have to recognize the connection between American and British policy and a terrorist act, that there is some possibility of negotiation?
I wouldn't go that far, to be honest. I'm really trying to identify the best approach to get most support to both domestically and internationally. My view is quite simply this, that the idea that the UK position and the US position and the Australian government's position in all of this can somehow be beyond argument is just absurd to me. And it almost begins to become sinister. And I just don't know why we're afraid of arguing about this.
All right. We're going to leave it at that for the moment. Come back, of course, to this subject in days to come. Thank you both for being with us, Dr. Paul Cornish at Chatham House in London, and Zainab Al-Suwaij, Executive Director of the American Islamic Congress in Boston. After the two attacks on London subways and buses, transit riders reportedly are taking to bicycles in large numbers in that city. In this country, though, the alert level is still at code orange, but Homeland Security officials reportedly are leaning toward dropping it back to yellow. Meantime, an ABC poll shows no increase in the concerns of Americans. 73% think a terror attack is likely, which has been the case since October 2001. 30% are worried a great deal, which is also unchanged. Meantime, though, around the country, different transit agencies are taking different kinds of precautions. And Pete Donahue reports on transit for the Daily News in New York. Pete, thanks for joining us.
Sure.
What are we seeing in the last couple of days?
Well, starting last night and more intensely this morning, we have police throughout the system, not at every station. We have 467 stations here. It's huge. They're randomly searching the backpacks and bags of riders before they enter the turnstiles.
Random searching. How many searches?
I don't know exactly how many searches they're doing, but they're at many stations, several stations. I was at my home station this morning, and they were checking just about everyone, including myself. And I switched trains and tried another station, and I walked right past a bunch of police officers. So they're certainly not stopping everybody.
Is there any pattern to who they're stopping that you can see?
So far, no. Men, women, black, white, every persuasion seems to be stopped and being let through.
Do people seem to be accepting of this, or is there any objection?
For the most part, I think most people are accepting, almost welcoming it. I talked to some people who were actually disappointed that their station wasn't one of the ones that had police. There are some people, of course, who are upset. There are people who I spoke to who approve of it, but were somewhat skeptical, but thought it was at least something. I think some people feel reassured. about it. And I think a large part of it is obviously the London bombings, but part of the acceptance, I think, is it's not really doesn't seem to be slowing things up very much, because they aren't making people, you know, get in a line for 5-10 minutes here in New York. If you did that, I think the city would be up in arms. But you know, the flow is into the stations does not seem to be slowed down, because they are, you know, going every 1, every 10, every 12, whatever. They have some protocol, apparently, and that seems to be the case.
So there's concern among transit riders, but the major concern for them is to get where they're going.
Yeah, I mean, the day of the London bombings, I rode the train. I live up in the Bronx and rode it all the way to Manhattan, spoke to probably 20, 25 riders on the subway here on different lines. And overwhelmingly, they were of the mind that, yeah, it's probably going to happen here again after 9/11, but they were not more concerned than they were the day before or the week before. They were reading their books, they were listening to the iPods and reading their papers, and it was like, if it's to be, it's to be kind of attitude.
I understand that the American Civil Liberties Union is concerned about this as a possible violation of the Fourth Amendment against unreasonable searches, and that there's some possibility of suit. It sounds to me as if the transit riders you spoke to wouldn't be supportive of that effort.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I spoke to a small sampling, but, I mean, you know, you talk to 10 people and you get 9 out of 10 the same response is probably fairly representative of what's going on around here. You know, I don't think people really mind. And several people were just very strongly thinking, you know, this is a great idea. Even if it's a 1 in 100 chance of stopping anything, I think they like seeing something, you know, very visible and tangible that the police are doing. A lot of the anti-security efforts seem to be behind closed doors and collecting intelligence and surveillance or alarms in tunnels or what have you. So I think they like to see, hey, they, you know, for crime reasons too, even though crime is really low, you know, I think people would like to see a police officer on every train.
Yeah, subways have in the past been relatively dangerous places. Has that not been the case of late, and are people, do you think, concerned that they might get risky again?
No, I mean, New York's subway system is amazingly safe. It carries about 4.7 million riders a day. And in the 6 major felonies that they track, they have an average of about 9 a day. And most of those are grand larcenies, which are pickpockets. So crime, it is relatively safe. I mean, you're most at danger of getting your wallet picked, and, you know, and you're most likely to have that happen in Manhattan. But crime is at almost all-time lows. And I think you see that by the ridership. I mean, ridership is very, very strong.
4.7 million as opposed to about 3 million, I think, in London. So it's a very, very large system, obviously. Pete Donahue with the New York Daily News. Lindsay Layton is a staff writer for the Washington Post, where there also have been new safety precautions installed. Lindsay, or I don't know if installed is the right term, but Lindsay Layton, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Warren. Happy to be here. That's right. Last night, for the first time, I think they did it once right after September 11th, but it's very rare indeed. They had a lockdown of the system. Unlike New York, the metro in D.C. closes at midnight on the weekdays, and that's a time when maintenance contractors come in. There's a lot of track rehab work that goes on while the system is shut down until it reopens again around dawn. And well, last night they kicked out all the contractors, many of whom don't have security clearances or, you know, any sort of background checks. They got everybody out of the system, and they brought in extra police shifts, and they combed it. They went through every station, looking in every nook and cranny. They went through all the tracks, you know, all the substation rooms, and just to make sure that there was nothing in there. They were looking for explosives, weapons, timing devices, anything that might have given them some concern, and they found nothing. So they said they had a clean system when they opened today. That was unusual.
Are they concerned about those contractors going in there on a regular basis without a security clearance? Is there any plan to try to crack down on them or to provide more surveillance, lest the wrong person get in there and leave something behind?
You know, I think that's something that they're debating right now. They've got a lot of work scheduled through the rest of the summer. The system is about it's 28 years old, excuse me, And it's at a point in its lifespan where it has a lot of infrastructure that has to be replaced. So they're doing a lot of work this summer. They're talking about what they can do to tighten up the access to the tracks.
They also, as I understand it, have been using police dogs, bomb-sniffing dogs. Are they evident all the time, or do they just go in after hours?
They've been using them actually during the peak, the morning rush and the PM rush. They really want to have a high visibility in the station with the dogs. They want, it's really, you know, it's basically, I think, very reassuring to passengers to see those canine units walking through the stations, walking onto trains, walking onto buses. And law enforcement tells me that that's really the best, most effective way to detect bombs. They don't really have technology that's practical that you can use in a transit situation, that, you know, no sort of portals that can sniff out bombs at this point, and dogs are the best way to go.
Do you get the same sense that Pete Donahue does, that transit riders would just as soon see more security rather than less?
Yeah, I do, Warren. In discussions with them, I was talking to the head of the group here called MetroRiders.org, which represents a couple of thousand riders, and he said that he'd support bag searches. That's as long as they're random and they're not using racial profiling, that he'd be supportive of that, and just individual riders seem comforted by the police presence and the notion that somebody's looking out for them and looking at scrutinizing other passengers.
Lindsay Layton with The Washington Post. Let me go back to Pete Donahue with the New York Daily News. If you go to London, and I think this has been true for some years now, there aren't any trash cans in the transit system. Is that the case in New York, or can you still dispose of things in those metal containers?
Well, they're still there. In fact, today at the number 4 train station up in Woodlawn, when I was talking to some riders, I saw two plainclothes police officers with a bomb-sniffing dog, and they were checking doors that lead to where some staffers, a staffer's lounge, I guess you might call it, mm-hmm. and they were checking equipment rooms and checked the garbage can, which is a metal container. You can't see into it. So, yeah, they're still there.
Lindsay Layton with The Washington Post. What about Washington? Are the trash cans still in the subways there?
Oh, no. They pulled them out shortly after 9/11, and they had been we've been trash barrel free for a few years now, and it's actually caused a garbage problem. We've got a lot of paper, a lot of stuff that people leave behind them in the stations. But the transit agency just purchased a whole supply of bomb-proof barrels, and they're bringing them back into the stations now. But these are bomb resistant. If anything explodes, they're not supposed to splinter, and they're supposed to contain the explosion.
Let's go across the country to Los Angeles, where Daniel Finkelstein is the captain, with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, serves as chief, though, of the transit police for the Metropolitan Transit Authority. Not as large as either of the systems in Washington or New York, but big enough. Captain Finkelstein, thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Does it make any difference to you whether the alert level is at orange or yellow? I understand that there may be a change in that. How would you respond to it?
Well, you know, we implemented something that was very similar to the orange immediately after the 7/7 bombings, and as far as increased staffing and whatnot. And then once that was official, then of course we continued with that. So the problematic thing from my perspective as someone running in a law enforcement security program for mass transit is when anytime there's a change, then your ridership wants to see something different. What are you doing? What are you doing different because of this change? And I just want to make sure that we are using our resources in a purposeful manner rather than something that's more show because the alert level changed.
On the other hand, presumably you have to serve those customers. What do you do? What have customers seen that is different?
We've brought in a lot more bodies. Our staffing has been increased probably 2- and 3-fold after 7/7, and we've got a lot of people out there today. And again, as your other guests have indicated, it's about making people feel safe. I flew in yesterday from a week in London that I spent with the British Transport Police, the London City Police, and the Metropolitan Police there, talking to them and getting some firsthand accounts of what their people did, and it was a great trip.
As a result of that, are you going to make any changes that you can talk about?
Well, I think one thing that we had underway before 7/7 was to increase our our closed-circuit television camera capabilities. That was something that we've been doing with Federal Department of Homeland Security grants, and that's going to continue. I hadn't had the opportunity before to see a state-of-the-art of the system as there exists, but it was just fantastic. And we were in their control center, and they, as an example, outside one of the subway stations. Of course, the whole city in London has got cameras, but they showed a man leaning up against a building, and the camera zoomed in on him, and he's eating a sandwich, and then they zoomed in on the sandwich, and you could tell what fast food it was and which one of the items on their menu that the man had in his hand. I mean, that's huge.
What would it take? We heard earlier, of course, that they have now released the pictures of four suspects in the bombings or the attempted bombings of yesterday, and they are apparently very recognizable in those pictures. What would it take to establish in Los Angeles what you refer to as a state-of-the-art closed-circuit television system?
Well, again, we're on our way to doing that. Just whatever federal monies we can get our way would be great. You know, and then with many of the closed-circuit cameras comes some intelligent software that recognizes behavior, like leaving an abandoned package and that kind of thing, because certainly the greatest camera in the world is only as good as the human that is tasked with monitoring it. So anytime that can be enhanced with other technology, that would be good. But I think that's where we all need to go.
Do you worry about the trash cans? Or is there such a thing as what Lindsay Layton described earlier as a bomb-resistant trash can?
Yes, there is, and we have some of those. We have very few trash cans in our subway system, especially down on the platforms. But then we do not allow any eating or drinking on the platform or in the cars either. But it's an interesting paradox that you have to reconcile: what is the hazard of trash cans versus not having trash cans? And now your tracks and the inside of your cars become the receptacle for the trash. Which is the greater risk for the quality of life issues.
Captain, stay with us for a moment. I just want to go back to our other guests and ask them about closed-circuit TV. Pete Donahue, first to you with the New York Daily News. What would it take, do you suppose, to establish a state-of-the-art closed-circuit television system in the New York subway?
Well, it's going to cost a lot of money. I know that they are expected to award about $400 million worth of contracts for security anti-terror program that they're just now starting to hit the construction stage later this year. And part of that will be what was just mentioned, which is what they call it, smart CCTV. Mm-hmm. They're going to be having sensors and camera hookup at the some of the tunnels, particularly the water tunnels, underwater tunnels, which are a big concern, that would trigger an alarm and send images to a command center and almost instantaneous police report. The problem with this is all new emerging technology, and how do you get a system that will tell you that that's a rat on the track as opposed to someone trying to do harm, or it can block out what you want to have, which is the train service. So it would cost an enormous amount of money. I know they're moving in that direction, at least for secure areas. I don't think we have too many that actually tape and record. Mm-hmm. They are out there. Certainly not as extensive as what is in London. And the feeling, at least up until this point, has been, that's great to have those things, but that's something after the fact.
Lindsay Layton with the Washington Post. We're just about out of time. But is there an effort to put those kinds of cameras in Washington?
Well, there's certainly an effort to seek the money for it. Washington, like New York, got a good amount of federal funds after September 11th. These are the two systems that really made out the best if you're looking around the country. But it's still Metro in D.C. got $49 million. They say they need something on the order of $140 million more. So they're certainly trying to make that case. It doesn't seem to be getting a lot of traction in Congress.
Got it. Captain Finkelstein, with the Transit Police in Los Angeles, there's been a lot of concern that the federal government's cutting back on assistance to local transit systems. Do you feel that in Los Angeles?
Well, again, we've been the recipient, beneficial recipient of a significant amount of money, and it's been great. Certainly more would help, and then you just wonder exactly how they will reconcile surface transportation versus aviation. And what we are discussing here in California is maybe we need to investigate, do inquiries about a Homeland Security surcharge on your surface transportation ticket, just like you pay on your airline ticket, and then use that funding to implement some of the issues we've discussed.
All right. Different systems, but some similarities from city to city, transit system to transit system. Thanks to all of you for being with us. Daniel Finkelstein, captain with the L.A. County Sheriff's Department and chief of the Transit Police. Lindsay Layton with the Washington Post. Pete Donahue with the New York Daily News. Good to have all of you with us. Time for a change of pace. Lance Armstrong has yet to win any one of the 19 stages held so far in this year's Tour de France, but his cumulative performance has him comfortably ahead of the pack. Tomorrow's a big day, though, if Armstrong is to win it all on Sunday for the seventh year in a row. More from France in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
Werman Olney with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Lance Armstrong says tomorrow's a big day, and he promises to give it everything he's got. It's a time trial that will determine the rider's standings before Sunday's final ride into Paris. Jeremy Whittle is cycling correspondent for the Times of London. He's editor of Pro Cycling Magazine. Jeremy, and I think you've been on our program for the last 3 years in a row, talking, of course, about Lance Armstrong. Is this all getting a little boring for cycling fans?
No, of course not. No, I'm sure that all American cycling fans are thrilled to bits. Perhaps some of us in the press corps are a little bit weary. If there is a sense of deja vu after 7 years of watching Lance win. So it'll be nice next year when we'll see a new champion. But obviously everybody's very respectful of his incredible achievement.
Well, I heard even Lance Armstrong saying that it's going to be a lot more interesting when he's not a competitor anymore. How certain is his victory on Sunday?
Well, the only thing that will stop him now is a major crash in the time trial tomorrow, and that's extremely unlikely, as he doesn't really have to race that hard tomorrow. He can race within himself. The pressure is on Jan Ulrich, the German rider who's often been his rival, to climb from fourth place overall to third place, which is kind of an honourable finish. Fourth place isn't for a rider of his stature. So the pressure's on Ulrich, and Lance can really, if it rains or if the course is, apparently the course is quite fairly tricky course with some fast bends and some downhill sections that are fairly technical. And Lance doesn't really need to take any risks there because he's still got this nearly 3-minute advantage over his nearest rival.
So when he says he's going to give it everything he's got, you sound a little sceptical about that. He doesn't really need to.
Well, I think everybody would like to see him win a stage in the yellow jersey. But I asked Johan Brunel, his team manager, about this yesterday, and he said panache. Who cares about panache? He's won 7 Tours de France. That's enough panache. And he's got a point. You know, he doesn't need to break a leg tomorrow to win a stage, because the big day for him is on the Champs-Élysées on Sunday when, lots of his Hollywood friends will be there, and I'm sure lots of Americans will be there to support him. And he doesn't need to take any risks. The race is won. The big thing for him is what happens on Sunday when he goes on the Champs-Élysées for the last time and then retires from the sport, which is an incredible finish, the finish he always wanted to achieve.
How much of an achievement is this in terms of athletics, and where does it put Lance Armstrong in the pantheon, if there is such a thing, of great athletes that we know about, at least, in world history?
Well, it's a remarkable achievement because he will retire unbeaten. We were just having a chat about this, actually, earlier on in the car on our way to our hotel tonight. And we were thinking, is there a comparison in world sport? But I guess the main thing about Lance is that he only focuses on one event, and he's won that one event 7 times in succession. And I guess from that point of view, he doesn't really compare with somebody who's trying to win all 4 majors in golf or the Grand Slam in tennis. It's a different thing. I mean, it's not as if he's tried to win some of the classic races they have in the spring, or that he's tried to win the Tour of Italy or the World Championships. Everything, his sponsorship, all his teammates, everybody's been prepared for this one event.
He, of course, overcame cancer. That's another extraordinary fact about him. And there have been in the past allegations of steroid use. Do you think that his achievement will always be stained by those accusations, or has he managed to fight them off effectively?
Well, I think he's fought them off very well, but unfortunately, because of the sport that he's the most successful rider in, and the event that he's the most successful rider in, which has always had allegations of doping leveled against it, that there'll always be a question mark over his achievements. It's just the climate that the sport inhabits, and the allegations will probably continue. Then the insinuations will continue long after after he retires. But I mean, as those who've leveled allegations against him admit, it's all circumstantial, and there has never been any hard evidence against him. And either that shows that he's got an extremely kind of well-honed machine around him, or that there isn't any foundation to those allegations.
Is there going to be anybody to replace him?
I think he's irreplaceable. I think he's irreplaceable in terms of the sport itself and in terms of what he's done for France and what he's done for cycling. I don't know anybody ever be anybody like him. It's hard to imagine that anybody could ever win 8 tours because, for a start, you'd need to start winning at a certain age and then end winning at a certain age as well. And I can't really see anybody who in the future could achieve that, because really it needs all these elements to fall into place. And there will never be a story. I can't imagine either that there ever be a story like his in cycling. There might be a story perhaps in other sports, but certainly in terms of cycling.
Well, thanks as always for being with us.
Pleasure.
Jeremy Whittle, cycling correspondent for the Times of London and editor of Pro Cycling Magazine, on the course at the Tour de France. Producers of To the Point, Francis Anderton, Christian Bordahl, Katie Cooper, Ileana Justice, Jonah King, and Sharon Rimbaum, managing producer Karen Radziner. Special thanks to Jennifer Son and Charisse Williams. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family, our technical directors Mike Newport. I'm Warman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and PRI.
Public Radio International.